Hi, I'm Rick Ryman, host of Audibly Speaking, a show on the stories behind the stories of our time. By sounding out on these stories, we give voice to them and hear them for the first time. From the news of the day to history and literature, from audiobooks to leaders on the stump, we examine the backstories of our time, audibly speaking. In this podcast series, I want to go through the chapters in the Warren Report. To summarize, many recordings have already been made which present the report word for word. You can go to LibriVox.org and you can find many narrations of the entire Warren Report. You can also go to Project Gutenberg and you can get ebooks for free of the entire 888-page Warren Report. But in this series, what I want to do is something a little different. I want to just summarize each chapter, and as we go through each chapter, I want to highlight those passages that are particularly important to historians and which raise questions about the work of the Warren Commission, also that highlight some of the strengths of the Commission's work so that we can see both sides. Now, Chapter 1, Summary and Conclusions, begins with an overview of the assassination. It talks about how the motorcade went. It discusses the political purpose of the motorcade, how the day started out rainy but quickly became sunny, and how the crowds were very warm and appreciative along the way. It also does a good job of summarizing the sequence of the shots as we know them today. And so this has been a particular strength of the Warren Report. It talks about a fact that the first shot that hit the president also hit Governor Connally, and then the next shot hit the president in the head. It talks about the race to Parkland Hospital, and it talks about the work of the doctors to try to save the president's life. They also managed to save Connally's life. And then we learn about the trip back to Washington by Air Force One. And then we turn to the witnesses of the assassination. There's a discussion of Howard Brennan, who saw the man shooting from the southeast corner of the Texas School Book Depository window, and the fact that at 12:45 p.m. Central Standard Time, the police radio broadcast a description of the suspected assassin based on Brennan's observations. It also talks about how the patrolman, Marion Baker, confronted Oswald in the second floor lunchroom following the assassination, within about 2 minutes of the assassination, according to this summary. And it trails Oswald through the pathway he took down Elm Street to the Oak Cliff bus, how the bus got stuck in traffic, how Oswald asked for a transfer, went to the local Greyhound station, picked up a cab, and was taken back to his rooming house. It points out that Oswald made sure that the taxi driver dropped him off beyond his boarding house so the taxi driver would not be able to report precisely where Oswald was headed. But then, of course, Oswald went to his boarding house, picked up a gun, which he put under his belt, put a jacket on, and then left to points unknown. We also learn about how Captain Will Fritz arrived at the Texas School Book Depository, found the rifle, or the rifle was found for him. They found a fourth live round in the rifle that was ejected, and they sent the rifle off to be identified as to source. The summary goes on to report how Oswald was identified in a lineup as the shooter of Officer J.D. Tippett some 10 minutes after he left the boarding house. And then we turn to a discussion of Oswald's early life, which is dealt with in some detail. But it quickly covers his service in the Marines, his decision to defect to the Soviet Union, his defection on October 16, 1959, how the Soviets allowed Oswald to stay indefinitely, during which time Oswald got married and had a child, a daughter, born in February 1962. Then it talks about how Oswald was tired of life in the Soviet Union and how he was dissatisfied there as he was everywhere and how he requested the Soviets a visa for his wife and child and himself to go back to the United States, which was finally granted to him. In 1962, he and his wife and child came back to the United States. It's discussed in this first chapter. And Oswald's difficulties of getting employment are discussed. His ability finally to get a job as a greaser of coffee processing machinery, and how he was able to settle down, so-called, in Fort Worth at a series of different apartment buildings. Oswald's flirtation with radical causes is also discussed in the first chapter. He formed a fictitious New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which consisted exactly of one member, himself, and a fictitious A.J. Heidel that was Oswald's own pseudonym. And we learn that Oswald tried to get to Cuba by visiting Mexico City in pursuit of a visa to Cuba, but that he was stymied in that effort, and the Cubans would not give him a visa unless the Soviets gave him one to go on to Russia. The Soviets turned Oswald down as well, so the Cubans stuck to their guns and did not grant Oswald the visa. So he had to go back to the United States with some feeling of depression, no doubt. On October 20th, the Oswald's second daughter, Rachel, was born. And by this time, Marina was living with Ruth Payne, and Oswald was visiting them on the weekends because he was rooming in a boarding house in Oak Cliff. It talks about the Thursday, the day before the assassination, when Oswald convinced Frazier to give him a ride back to the Irving home of Mrs. Payne, where Oswald's rifle was located in Mrs. Payne's garage. How Oswald, no doubt, went to the garage when he was not watched and filled up a paper bag with his disassembled rifle. The next morning, leaving the house, leaving his wedding ring for Marina, leaving $170, which was his entire life fortune, but for $13.87, which Oswald kept in his pocket. And Oswald took the package to Frazier's house, and Frazier drove Oswald and his package to the Texas School Book Depository on the morning of November 22nd. It talks about how Marina was watching television when the news came in that the president had been shot, and how Ruth and Marina mentioned that the shooting took place right next to the Texas School Book Depository where Oswald worked. How Marina went into the garage to make sure the rifle was still there, and how she saw the blanket which enclosed the rifle, seemingly untouched. She didn't try to detect whether the rifle was still there. She just wanted to believe that it was. But that afternoon, when the police came to Irving at 3 p.m., police officers asked Marina if Oswald had a rifle, and Marina said yes, and she took him to the garage where the rifle was located, and when they lifted up the blanket, they noticed the rifle was not there. It also talks about the arrangements that were made for Oswald's transfer to the Dallas County Jail on the morning of November 24th, when, shortly after 11 o'clock a.m., as Oswald was being transferred, Jack Ruby raced from the side of the crowd and shot Oswald in the abdomen, killing him. There is some discussion of the indictment of Ruby and the fact that Ruby was put on trial and found guilty on March 14, 1964, and sentenced to death. The chapter ends with its conclusions. The conclusions are fairly straightforward, but also fairly convincing in terms of making it clear that the evidence is powerful against Oswald, that there's very little room for doubt that Lee Harvey Oswald fired the shots that killed President Kennedy. How he did it, however, is not well described by the report, especially in the summary, as we will see. Here are the conclusions in the summary, and I will abridge the conclusions as well. A, witnesses at the assassination saw a rifle being fired from the sixth-floor window. B, the nearly whole bullet found on Governor Connally's stretcher matched the Mannlicher Carcano rifle that was fired on the sixth floor. C, the three used cartridge cases found near the window were from the same rifle, the Mannlicher Carcano, that Oswald owned. D, The windshield was struck by a bullet fragment on the inside, showing that the bullet had been fired from behind. E, the nature of the bullet wounds suffered by President Kennedy and Governor Connally, established that the bullets were fired from above and behind the presidential limousine. 1. President Kennedy was first struck by a bullet which entered at the back of his neck and exited through the lower front portion of his neck, causing a wound which would not necessarily have been lethal. The president was struck a second time by a bullet which entered the right rear portion of his head, causing a massive and fatal wound. 2. Governor Connally was struck by a bullet which entered on the right side of his back, traveling downward through the right side of his chest, exiting below his right nipple. This bullet then passed through his right wrist and entered his left thigh, where it caused a superficial wound. F. There is no credible evidence that shots were fired from the triple underpass, ahead of the motorcade, or from any other location. And of course, that point is a good one because notice the adjective. There is no credible evidence. There certainly have been allegations of a shot from the grassy knoll. In fact, the House Select Committee thought that there was such a shot, although it missed. But the Warren Commission is on firm ground in saying that there is no credible evidence of this. Point 3, though, that follows is one of the most controversial statements in all of the Warren Report. And I will quote it. Although it is not necessary to any essential findings of the commission to determine just which shot hit Governor Connally, there is very persuasive evidence from the experts to indicate that the same bullet which pierced the president's throat also caused Governor Connally's wounds. End quote. Well, this statement is one of the worst statements in the entire Warren Report because it says it is not necessary for this conclusion to be accepted in order to accept the idea that Oswald fired all the shots. And yet it is necessary. It's absolutely necessary because upon an observation of the Zapruder film, it is obvious that there is not enough time between the reactions of John Connally and the reactions of JFK to that second shot for them to have been hit by separate shots. If there were two shots in so slight a time, then there had to have been two different gunmen. But if the two men were just reacting at slightly different times to the same shot that hit both men, then the single bullet theory stands up. So the Warren Commission is quite in error in saying that it is not necessary to the commission's findings to believe in the single bullet theory, the idea that one shot hit both men. In fact, it's absolutely necessary. And it's just that the Warren Commission made an excellent case for the single bullet theory. And in fact, the single bullet theory has stood the test of time. So all the Warren Commission had to do to avoid the confusion that this sentence caused was to say that the Warren Commission has determined that both men were hit by the same bullet. Whether it was the first shot or the second or the third didn't matter as much. That one shot hit both men at some point. And that's all they had to say. 4, the shots which killed President Kennedy and wounded Governor Connally were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, this is necessarily flowing from all of the evidence covered thus far. But in addition, the Mannlicher Carcano was traced directly to Oswald, who purchased it using a money order with his fake ID, Alec Heidel. Heidel was a pseudonym that Oswald used, and in fact, he carried it on his person when he was arrested. B. Oswald carried this rifle into the depository building on the morning of November 22, 1963. There can be no doubt of this. C. Oswald, at the time of the assassination, was present at the window from which the shots were fired. His description matched perfectly, or nearly perfectly, Howard Brennan's description. D. Shortly after the assassination, the Mannlicher Carcano rifle belonging to Oswald was found partially hidden between some cartons on the sixth floor, and the improvised paper bag in which Oswald brought the rifle to the depository was found close by the window from which the shots were fired. Now, opponents of the Warren Commission say that this is hard to believe, that Oswald would leave such damning evidence right around the perch where the shooting took place. Why didn't he pick up the rifle shells? Why didn't he pick up the paper bag and try to dispose it or hide it somewhere else? This is just too complete, some people would say. Well, it's possible, in fact probable, that Oswald was not worried very much about hiding his tracks. Oswald, remember, wanted to be a change agent in history. He wanted to be remembered for 10,000 years as a man who changed the course of history. And so it would not help Oswald in this goal if he was not tied to the assassination eventually. Oswald did deny that he shot President Kennedy because he wanted to have it both ways. He wanted to be wrongfully accused, like the Rosenbergs, the heroes to Oswald, who had motivated him by their story to become a political actor in history. He wanted to be wrongly accused like them, but at the same time, he wanted to be accurately remembered as the man who shot JFK. Perhaps not quite at the same time. Perhaps the latter goal was Oswald's long-term goal, but the idea of being wrongfully accused, which he was able to try to engineer by denying that he had anything to do with the killing of JFK, was his short-term goal, which was accomplished by simply denying the charge. There would be time enough, Oswald figured, wrongly as it turned out, there would be time enough for him to claim his place in history. But leaving the evidence at the scene of the crime was both inevitable, since Oswald did not have the time to secret this evidence, and he certainly didn't want it to be found on his person if he was searched later. It was not only inevitable, as I say, but it was also consistent with his goal of being tied to the assassination, ultimately, in the long run, to claim his place in history. E, based on testimony of the experts and their analysis of films of the assassination, the commission has concluded that a rifleman of Lee Harvey Oswald's capabilities could have fired the shots from the rifle used in the assassination within the elapsed time of the shooting. Oswald killed Dallas Police Patrolman J.D. Tippit approximately 45 minutes after the assassination. And within 80 minutes of the assassination, Oswald was arrested, resisting arrest, at the theater, the Texas Theater, in the course of attempting to shoot another Dallas police officer. The commission also said in its summary that it has found no evidence that either Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby was part of any conspiracy, domestic or foreign, to assassinate President Kennedy. And they go on to say, the reasons for this conclusion are, the commission has found no evidence that anyone assisted Oswald in planning or carrying out the assassination. B, the commission has found no evidence that Oswald was involved with any person or group in a conspiracy to assassinate the president, although it has thoroughly investigated, in addition to other possible leads, all facets of Oswald's associations, finances, and personal habits, particularly during the period following his return from the Soviet Union in June 1962. Now, this statement also has inspired some controversy, because even as the Warren Commission was publishing its report and freezing these words into time, the Warren Commission was still investigating the Sylvia Odio story. Sylvia Odio was a Dallas woman who had lived in Puerto Rico and Cuba and who was a person who was a representative of the anti-Castro Cuban community in the United States. And according to Sylvia Odio, three men showed up on her doorstep, her apartment door, in late September 1963. And one of these men, she said, was Oswald. Two other men were anti-Castro Cubans. And so, according to Sylvia Odio, they wanted help in their efforts to fight Castro. The implication being that if Oswald was one of the three men, he was in the process of trying to infiltrate an anti-Cuban group, just as we know he had earlier that year in New Orleans. And if this is the case, according to Sylvia Odio, one of the three men, not Oswald, but one of the other three men, said that Oswald had suggested that JFK be assassinated. Now, Sylvia Odio's story has never been proven or disproven, but the Warren Commission was in the process of still trying to run it to ground or disprove it if it could, and had not completely disproven it. So for the Warren Commission to say that it had found no evidence that Oswald was involved with any person or group in a conspiracy to assassinate the president was literally true and technically true, but was not quite true in the manner in which we probably define truth, because the Warren Commission had not closed off the possibility that the Odio story was true. In fact, no one has ever been able to completely disprove this theory or completely prove the negative, that it did not happen. So this is a rather minor problem with the report, but it has attracted some conversation. There's also criticism of the Secret Service and how the Secret Service had especially poor security on November 22nd. Finally, the chapter closes with recommendations primarily in the area of presidential security, recommendations that have prevented another presidential assassin in all the years since November 22, 1963. So closes the very first chapter of the Warren Commission, Summary and Conclusions. Until our next episode, Chapter 2 of the Warren Report, The Assassination, this is Rick Ryman, your host. Happy listening. That's it for today's episode of AudiblySpeaking.com. New podcast episodes appear on AudiblySpeaking.com approximately once every 2 weeks. Please subscribe to Audibly Speaking on iTunes or whatever podcast aggregator you enjoy.